Welcome to the CBS Sports Basketball Podcast. I'm your host, Matt Moore. You can find me on Twitter, at MattMooreCBS. Or this week, indulging in 90s nostalgia for basketball all over the place, at HP Basketball. Joining me is Brad Bakken, NBA writer for CBS Sports. Brad, how's it going?
Good, good. Let's get it going.
All right, so we're going to talk about a number of things today. First up, we are going to talk about conferences and why they got to go. You know, you've been on this crusade for a while now when you were working as an editor last year. We kind of worked out an article and never really got into the right place on it. We're going to be doing a lot more on this subject in the coming weeks. But basically, it's time for conferences to go, and everyone knows it. And yet, for some reason, the NBA won't wrangle its owners into making this happen, and it needs to occur.
Yeah, I think we're past the point of anybody disagreeing, at least any logical thinker, that we don't need to do something about the conference imbalance. It's so dramatic. All relevant points that it's going to be hard to get Eastern owners to agree to any sort of revamping of the system, because the bottom line is it's easier for them to make the playoffs and a lot of things come with that. You just sent me a really interesting article that The Ringer did, pointing out all the reasons that Eastern owners wouldn't want to do that. Fan loyalty, building loyal fans, a lot of things more than just gate receipts for a few more playoff games. But I just have to believe that on some level, the NBA is a business. That's what all of these people who go against and say we can't have conference realignment or playoff restructuring because the NBA is a business and the Eastern owners won't agree to it. Well, the overall NBA is also a business. And I think it's getting into a dangerous territory where the overall business of the NBA, as evidenced by the ratings this year in the playoffs with such fewer games, if we start having complete busts of finals like, say, the NFL had in Super Bowls for about a 14-year stretch in the late 80s and I think into the up to 97, I think, was the first time that in 14 years that an AFC team won when Denver beat Green Bay. For 14 years, the Super Bowl was a joke. It was a complete joke. So the NFL's in a good place right now, but you have these periods of time where it can't be good for the overall league. And I think at some point that overall problem, whether the Eastern owners will agree to it or not, has to come to a head.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. I wrote a thing about kind of the Warriors and how they're presenting a problem for the league earlier, you know, last week, talking about the specific issue that is, you know, one of the reasons the cap was down, a big reason the cap was down, is because of the lower revenues from the playoffs. Like, that's just simply a fact, is that the NBA, like, the lack of competitive playoff games has created a situation where it's just simply not as profitable, and is having a tangible effect on the league. I think that's going to have to be addressed. But, you know, when you look at conferences, I guess my only response there would be, okay, well, we know that the Jazz were a good team, and we know that the Spurs were a good team, and the Warriors still mowed through those teams. If the conferences were realigned, if there was no conferences in the playoffs, do we think the Cavs would have gone to five or more in a lot of their series? Because they took the number one team in the Eastern Conference, the Celtics, who were still fourth overall in the league, and they ripped them to shreds. Is there anything that would, how would conferences really wind up fixing this problem that's more immediate?
Well, in my opinion, the journey to the destination of a finals and an ultimate championship for one team is what the value is. Like the beauty of the NCAA tournament is the journey of all the six rounds of getting there. And even if it ends up the same, even if it still ends up Warriors Cavs in the finals and the Warriors win in five, to me, the journey to getting there is what's the problem. You're not seeing Rockets Celtics. You have no chance of seeing Raptors, Jazz. And I think that you're losing such interest. There's almost no reason to tune into a first round series, even a second round series in a lot of cases. And I think shuffling up the matchups, making a team like Cleveland, yeah, they still might get there, but they're not going to want to only win 51 games in the regular season and end up with a fifth seed and have to play San Antonio in the second round.
That's true.
And so it's the process of getting there, to me, that is the ultimate reason for doing this. I think it's easy to say, well, who cares if you get rid of the conferences, the Warriors are still going to win. And right now, at this moment in time, that's probably true. But the key to me is creating a situation where we're interested and have reason to watch, and there's new excitement for new fans with new matchups. And I think this is true for all the major sports leagues. I think having such a difference between divisions or conferences, whatever they're called in baseball, like, it's a joke. You play an entirely different game than you play in the National League than you play in the American League. It's an entirely different game. It'd be the equivalent of not having three-pointers in the East, but you do in the West. And I don't understand how these things don't change. I was in the office, and I've been on this get rid of the conferences crusade for a long time. I was in the office maybe 6 weeks ago. Brady Quinn was in there, obviously big football guy. I end up talking about conferences. I relate it over to NFL. I say, Brady, why can't we get rid of conferences in the NFL? He says, well, there's no problem with the NFL. There's great parity in the league. And I think that's the whole problem with the cyclical. Or fine, it's okay right now. It's okay right now. But it wasn't when the NFC was killing the AFC for 14 years, and that might be the case again in 10 years. And so the whole cyclical argument that, well, 10 years from now or 5 years from now, the East is going to be the dominant conference. Well, then you have the same problem, only the reverse. So, again, I think it's the process of getting there, the first and second round matchups.
Well, okay, let's talk about that then. So I want to talk about the first round in a minute, but if we look at the second round, we had Warriors Jazz, which was arguably the most competitive series that they actually played. You had Spurs Rockets, which went 6 and very easily could have gone 7. Especially if Game 5 doesn't flip the way that it does. I think the Rockets win that series if they win Game 5. You had Cavs-Raptors, which was going to be a walk no matter what. And you had Celtics-Wizards, which went 7 games and was really competitive and was, you know, pretty tight. There were a couple blowouts in there, but overall the series in itself was competitive. So you had two really competitive series and two not-so-competitive series. For you, is it just a matter of Celtics-Wizards-Rockets-Spurs isn't compelling enough?
No, I think we need more of those series. You know, I don't think one or two series is enough. And I would say that also for lack of a better term, the freshness of matchups. I think this is a problem in the NFL. I'm sick of seeing Houston and Cincinnati or some variation of that, and Kansas City, Houston in the first round, whatever. I think seeing the Clippers play the Raptors, seeing the Bucks take on the Jazz, are really interesting series that sort of reinvigorate the interest in these players. I think we want to see Giannis playing in a more meaningful series than he's going to get an opportunity to play in the East. I think we want to see if these teams that are propped up on playing in the East, like I believe the Raptors are, like last year you believe the Celtics were, and see them challenged. I think we want to answer these questions about would LeBron actually, the things that we build his legacy on. He's been to 8 finals, 7 in a row. I think we can all agree that that's a product of being in the East. That doesn't take anything away from his greatness. When Kevin Durant went to the Warriors, everybody talked about all the reasons that they thought he went there. He couldn't play with Russ. He wanted to get away from that. He couldn't win a championship. And all these different things. Even the one, you know, outside the court. He wanted to go there and sort of expand his life personally and get into other ventures. And all those, probably truth in all those. But the one thing people sort of gloss over is he had to play in the West. And he went to the better team in the West. So that's not a problem. But look, when the Thunder almost beat the Warriors, you were at that series. You covered that series. Did a great job. Really chronicled how on the ropes the Warriors were until Klay Thompson went crazy in Game 6. That was a phenomenal Thunder team. Okay? They were the only team, I think there was only two teams in history that had to go through two plus 10 point differential teams in the same season. And they were gonna have to go through three. They had to go through San Antonio, then they had to get through Golden State only to get to Cleveland. And so, why would you want to stay in that situation? Kevin Durant, Chris Paul, this idea, oh, he's only been to one conference finals. He's a loser. If he was in the East, he'd be going to the conference finals every year. So there's just so many things being affected by this.
I agree. I mean, I agree on most of those points. I think it's funny. I talked to a couple people out in Vegas and asked them what they would change about the league, executive type people. And I was shocked at how many said the same thing, which is I got multiple people that said they should make the first round one and done. They said it would be the revenue is why they wouldn't, but the interest level will be so much higher. Your ratings and your ticket sales would be so much higher. It would generate a way more profile of the league if there really was a chance for it to be one and done. And then you play out the rest of the playoffs in seven-game format. But you take the first round and you put it into one and done. Daryl Morey talked about this on the Bill Simmons podcast as well when he did it in July. I think that's a really interesting idea, and it's like there would be a lot of objections to it from people that love this league, because the NBA is the one sport where you're definably able to say the best team wins 90% of the time. In baseball, there's a lot of random factors. There's just randomness built into baseball. Same with hockey. Any low-scoring game, there's a lot of randomness built in. Football, like weather, changes the outcome of football games, period. Like, it just does. Like, if you're a really great team and you play in Miami, and then all of a sudden you wind up and you're playing in Green Bay, like, you're screwed. Like, there's no way around it.
Right, and also the point that they're only playing one game. And that's a huge thing. If you play one game in basketball, to your point, anything can happen in one game in any sport. Baseball's done it with the wild card. A lot of people are opposed to the one-game playoff, but it's a lot of drama. I think, to your point, what would be very interesting is at what point, and on some level, this is sort of an intangible thing at this point, but at what level is the NBA as a whole so much better off that you can get into revenue sharing forms that will still benefit teams that don't make more than it would to just stay with the status quo and keep getting your first round playoff money?
Right.
That's sort of the question. If the league was better as a whole, I mean, I agree with you that the reason the best team always wins in the NBA is the 7-game series. I mean, the truth comes out over time. I think a one and done would be very dangerous because you don't want the Golden State Warriors having an off game in the first round. While that one game would be very dramatic in the structure as a whole, you don't want to be going, that's sort of what sucks about the NCAA tournament is it's all fun and we love the drama. But then like when Kentucky and Duke go out in the first round, to Murray State, we don't want to be watching Murray State in the Final Four. We want the upsets, but then later in the tournament, we want the big matchup. So
this solves it by having it only be that first round, right? Because even if the Warriors got knocked out, and the ratings would take a dip, there's no question the ratings would take a dip, but if the Warriors got knocked out by Giannis and the Bucks, for example, in a first round matchup, in a 1-16 first round matchup,
right?
You would still have in the next round, the Bucks would get reseeded as like, you know, under whatever spot they would wind up in, the 8, I guess, they would wind up in like the 8 seed, and then you would still have Cavs versus or Spurs versus Bucks in a 7-game series, and it's very unlikely that the Bucks wind up upsetting that, and you would still have a greater opportunity for other teams to kind of raise up and look awesome, like the Thunder or these other teams, to have those kind of chances. I think that it would make it really compelling. Plus, Morey pointed out on the Simmons podcast, he's like, we have the highest rate of individual, like, great teams beating these lower opponents of any sport in the league. Like, and it bears out, right? Like, the Warriors, we've talked about this before, the Warriors are such an outlier, but even like the Spurs. Like, the Spurs are going to be an 8-seeded team 9 times out of 10. Will it happen occasionally in a one and done? Sure. But where it gets interesting is when you have more of the matchups of like the 3 versus 14. Like that's when it starts to get really interesting. Is those kind of teams we get knocked off. And you see the same thing in the NCAA tournament, right? Where a 1 seed almost never loses to a 16 seed, or hasn't lost to a 16 seed. It hasn't happened. So, but you've seen 2-15s and you've seen 3-4s. Those matchups, I think, are the ones where you would get more drama. And you could arguably say that would maintain, might even exacerbate the problem, though, where the Warriors would win almost every time, but like the Cavs might get knocked out. Like I have a way higher concern about LeBron being knocked out of the playoffs and that impacting, because like, if LeBron goes out, now what? Like, you know, if the Warriors are going to roll through everybody and LeBron's out, now you start to wonder about, okay, well, why are you watching the playoffs at all?
Right. Well, also, I think the key is to not ever evaluate this stuff based on current circumstances. So, like, right now it would suck if LeBron went out. It would suck if the Warriors went out. But you sort of have to, when LeBron's not in the league 10 years from now, 15 years from now, when the Warriors are no longer good anymore, I think you want to implement a structure that makes sense for the viewer, no matter who's playing. And I think, again, let's say, to use your example, you have, you know, somehow the Bucks knock off the Warriors and then they go to a 7-game series in the next round and now they actually have to be a good team. And now that series stinks because they're not actually a good team. They got through on sort of a gimmick structure. And now that second round series, I think you've got to set up a structure that every round sort of gets increasingly or at least stays as intriguing. I would be a big, big fan of a three-game series in the first round because still it's going to be tough for the Bucks to beat the Warriors twice. But there you go again. It's reasonable hope going into the series. I have a reason to watch this. Okay. And then maybe you go to a five-game series in the second round. And then you go 7-7 when the big dogs are supposed to be playing. I think that'd be really interesting. Five-game series can throw a lot of things into the mix. Now, remember when the Nuggets team knocked off, who was it, the Sonics? When the 8-1, that's because it was a five-game series. I think a 3-5-7-7 would be really interesting. And at this point, I think it would be a step in the right direction, even if you didn't get to schedule balance in the regular season right away.
I agree. I don't think schedule balance is necessary. I think you can keep the schedule balance in the regular season and just say, you know, look, if you play in a tougher conference, you're always going to have an imbalance of schedules. This happens in the NFL that has more kind of disparity because they've only got 16 games. They've got a wider range of opponents. It doesn't change the fact that you're still going to have it be, well, you played, you know, this year you randomly play the NFC South, which is down or whatever. Like, there's always going to be unequal schedules. You're never going to get to a point where, unless you radically change everything and you're just going to say, you're going to play every team twice, like, and you drop it down to 60 games or whatever, you're never going to get there. And I don't think that's realistic to ask of the owners or the players because nobody wants to lose that money. There are people in the league that would be willing to lose that money because they think it would make the product better, but you're not going to sell the wholesale on that. But my biggest thing is don't make perfect the enemy of good. Don't make it to where it's like, well, you got to fix the schedule. No, you don't. Just fix the playoffs because that's what people care about. Let's make that good. And if you get to a point where you're like, it really is a schedule issue, this is out of whack, we want to fix this next, you can fix that. Let's go to no conferences. Let's see how much better the league is, and then we can go from there.
That's very well said. Don't let perfect. I like that. Don't let perfect be the enemy of good. That's absolutely true. Right now, there's imbalance in the postseason and there's imbalance in the regular season. So we're playing with both. Let's get rid of one of them. So to your point, the playoffs are more important. And look, the league obviously recognizes this not only because David Silver. I always do that. Adam Silver, who looks like Slugworth, by the way. Every time I look at Adam Silver, I think of Slugworth. But they've already addressed this in that they got rid of the automatic top four seed for a division winner. Why? Because we're not going to reward a team for being in a stink comp or a stink division.
Yeah.
Right? So they've already, in terms of how this plays out and sort of like the reason you do it, and the integrity of implementing something is because they know that you need some form of equality in terms of what kind of playoff positioning you get. So they've already dumped the top four seed for playing in a weak division. It'd be the same principle doing it for conferences. And look, the same teams would get in. That's fine. Even if Eastern owners won't go for this idea of getting the top 16 teams in because in any given year, by the way, it wouldn't change it that much. I think, you know, on some years, maybe 9 Western teams would get, it would change the seeding is what it would change.
Yes.
But the same, for the most part, and you could say that could be because of regular season schedule imbalance, but if we say that we keep that variable fixed and schedule stays as it is, most of those Eastern teams are still going to get in.
Yep.
Okay, it's just gonna, the seeds are gonna be different and the matchups are gonna be different and it sort of like just reinvigorates this whole product. So put the same 6 teams in but cross seed.
One part of it is the ones that are gonna get in like really should not have a part in this conversation. If you cannot finish above 500, I do not care. Like,
right, but to your point, I don't care either, but to your point, those owners care. So we gotta look at it in reality.
But those owners shouldn't care either. Because the owners, you know, the Bulls are an interesting example because it's like, look, they had a real chance to knock off the Celtics. Okay, fair enough. But you didn't. And most of the time when you are an 8 seed or you are a 7 seed in the Eastern Conference, you're not going anywhere. You're going home. Like, you're gonna get a few games of playoff revenue. Great. Okay, couple. Here's an idea. Don't overpay on a few guys that aren't going to help your team as much. Like, manage your team better. You can save that money anyway. Like, there's just a lot of ways that these arguments don't hold water. Speaking of arguments that don't hold water, by the way. So, we know that the Eastern teams not wanting to lose their playoff spot is the one. That's like the argument that's the real reason behind their resistance to this. But what's been stated over and over again, and when I asked the league about this last summer, their simple answer was travel. Travel remains the concern for it. And there are those that don't think it's anything at all. And there are those that think it's a significant problem because, I mean, there's been significant research done, especially by ESPN Tom Haverstroh, about the impact of flight travel on NBA bodies and how it impacts your ability to effectively play basketball. I think those concerns are legitimate. I think adding a lot of extra travel onto these things is problematic. However, I have a solution, okay?
I'm ready.
I'm going to be writing a lot more about this in the next couple of weeks for a project that we're working on. The thing is, all right, I liked the 2-3-2 format of the finals a couple of years ago because of how it was kind of structured. They changed it because of kind of how it got weird for both the media and the players, but that was on a truncated finals schedule. Here's the deal. If you give the higher seed, if you go to 16 overall and you give the higher seed a choice because they have home court and they finish with a better record. If you want this choice, you need to be able to get a better record. The top seed in each individual matchup gets to choose between a 2-2-1-1-1 series and a 2-3-2 series. I was curious about what this would actually look like. So I actually ran the numbers and I looked at like Google Maps and pulled the distance between 2 points, which isn't going to factor flight time or weather patterns or any of that stuff, but it at least gives you an idea of miles traveled. I was shocked at the results, Brad. I compared a Lakers-Knicks series with a Lakers-Wolves series, which would mean roughly half the distance, right? Like, you can have Lakers-Wolves, theoretically, not next year because the Lakers are still going to be terrible, but in 2 years, you could conceivably have a Lakers-Wolves first-round series. Yeah. Both those teams are in the West.
Yeah.
If a Lakers-Wolves series goes 7 games under 2-2-1-1-1, the lower seed will have traveled 7,500 miles, okay?
Mm-hmm.
A Lakers-Knicks series...
If it goes seven?
If it goes seven.
Okay.
If a Lakers-Knicks series under 2-3-2 goes 7 games, it goes 7,300, 200 miles less. That's if you get the most extreme matchup between 2 points, the Lakers and New York. I ran the same numbers for Portland-Miami versus Portland-New Orleans and got the same results. These things get very, and they wind up being very close to each other as it goes, and that's just for the lower seeds. Like, the top seeds, who are more likely going to win, save a ton of mileage on these things. Like, it's crazy how much those things wind up saving them.
Well, look, what did you do right there? You're looking for a solution to the problem, and you found it, I would suspect, fairly easily. And you ran the numbers, and there's a way to make it work. Screw with the format of the playoff series. Try to find a way to make it work. I think in that Ringer article you just sent me, and I think we can both agree that what the NBA is doing is the travel's the scapegoat. The travel's not really the issue. The issue is they can't get the owners to pass it through, and so they're looking for reasons of why it can't work to say publicly. The travel, listen, I'm with you that this travel is a big thing. I'm also on the side of like the common person to some degree where like, look, everything can't be perfect. These guys are making $200 million. They can fly 90 extra minutes in the worst case scenario on a chartered flight. Like, let's not get so scientific here that now we're looking at like the extra 17 minutes of sleep that you get or whatever your leg circulation is for the 60 minutes you're on a chartered flight. It's not that I'm totally dismissing that extra travel sucks for everyone, but everyone doesn't make the money these guys make. There's certain things asked of people in the greater interest of the business that you work for. And NBA players are given more than enough. More than enough. So they can give this little back that would help the product of the overall game. I just don't buy the travel thing. I mean, look, the Pistons could end up playing the Wolves in a cross series. That's like, you know, they could drive a car to their series. Right. Like, right now, Portland can end up playing Memphis. To your point, Minnesota can play Phoenix. There's still a lot of travel issues that go right now. Why are the Bulls in the East? Or why, you know, Denver could play Chicago. It's easy to say, okay, if Portland plays Miami, like the most extreme example, but there's a lot of series cross conference that aren't going to be any problem at all.
Right. If OKC plays Milwaukee, that's not a problem. If OKC plays Chicago, that's not a problem. Like if
there's
OKC,
a lot of teams in Indiana, yeah. Memphis. There's all kinds of series that aren't going to be a problem. And like I said, even the ones that are, maybe you do something like you suggested. And I like that idea. And maybe you don't even leave it to the top seed. Maybe the league just steps in and says, look, we're here to protect the players, but also the product. So over this amount of travel time for a 7-game series, this is it. It's 2-3-2. That's it. And then it changed, and that's it. And you won't have, you will always have people arguing, well, this team got to play in a 2-3-2, so they had an advantage. Well, right now, people are arguing that this team plays in the East, and this team plays in the West. Again, I love that. Don't let perfect be the enemy of good. There's a better way to do this. Let's get closer to perfect. Let's keep moving there. And the travel thing is a joke to me. Like I said, and I like your idea, but even if you throw out all of the restructuring to account for players' bodies and all these different things, even if you don't change a thing, I am not buying that 90 extra minutes on a chartered flight is the reason to not change what is a glaring, glaring problem in the league. Not that I don't think it's an issue, but it is not in no way that big of an issue.
It's a challenge to be accommodated for and to be worked around, not a challenge to say we shouldn't do it.
Yeah, but I would say that even if you couldn't, which I think we're both in agreement, you obviously can work around it. This is a scapegoat for the league not wanting to just come out and say, well, the Eastern Conference wants to be rewarded for being mediocre.
But I think part of my thing is, and that's why I've been working on these kind of solutions for it, is I don't want them to have that excuse, right? If we say, like, okay, you know, you're worried about this. Well, in a 7-game series, you're actually traveling less under 2-3-2. Here's your solution. Like,
you're going defense attorney here.
Yes.
And you say, okay, look, I'm gonna preempt your rebuttal.
Yeah.
And I take all your ammo away from you. That would be a very smart way for these things to be positioned.
Yeah, because it's like, I mean, again, if you're the lower seed in a matchup that's 2-3-2, you're flying three times. That's three flights. That's it. Versus back and forth, back and forth, back and forth in the end of those matchups. Those four or five, or that 5-6-7 in a 2-2-1-1-1, that's brutal.
That adds up. Absolutely.
Like you're on a flight, you play a game, or you have usually they fly the night of. So you're on a flight, you play the next day, or the day after that, you fly again. Like it's just constant. And that, I think, wears on them.
It's tough.
But
it's tough. Well, Ken Berger did with us a couple of years ago, did a really interesting piece. He tracked players' sleep pattern, and there was significant data to support the fact of how much better the product is when guys get 8 hours of sleep. And there's a lot of reasons why they don't, you know, when they're on back-to-back, certain travel issues, and it's like, okay, here he got 8 hours, here he got four, because he had to be up for shoot-around, and the production was significant enough that you could say that this is something that's trackable and reasonable to say we need to fix it.
The thing is, in the first round, you'd have more of these, right? And so part of this is, if you notice in the first round, it drives me crazy because it's like some teams will play Saturday night and then they'll play again on Monday. Some teams don't play again until Tuesday after Saturday. And then some teams will play Monday night and not play again until Friday. Like, all of these schedules are messed up for both TV reasons and travel. This would simplify things a lot, even if they chose the 2-2-1-1-1. You'd be able to get these series done faster, actually, because you wouldn't have to bake in all that travel time, and you'd have a kind of a more disparity, like, oh, it makes more sense for this team to go this next day. And so you wouldn't have these weird situations where two teams have 2 days off, and so, you know, one team that might have typically been playing with a guy that couldn't get back because of injury now gets to because he had an extra day. You want to eliminate those things. So all of these things kind of add up. I want to move on. You did a really great breakdown last week on Lonzo Ball and his summer league performance and got really knee-deep into a lot of stuff. I thought, in particular, how you noted his sidewinder shooting motion, how that's going to be complicated in the NBA. How good do you think Lonzo Ball is going to be next year?
Next year is going to be tough. I think we talked last week about Curry being to some degree a product of the system and the players that are around him, whereas another player, maybe like a Westbrook or a Harden, is maybe more self-sustaining and can do what he does in any set of circumstances. I think that might be somewhat true of Lonzo Ball and, say, a guy like De'Aaron Fox. I think De'Aaron Fox is going to be De'Aaron Fox in pretty much any situation. I think Lonzo Ball gets better the better players you put around him, and the Lakers aren't going to have a lot of great players next year. But for what he does really, really well, I think you have to have players to finish and complement the things that he starts. Cause he's a starter on the court. He starts plays. He gets the pace going. He gets the tempo going. He starts the ball movement. He's not going to always be the one that finishes it. And having that in place has to ultimately have the people at the end of the chain to finish the play. I think if they end up getting George, And I mean, hell, if they get LeBron, but I mean, if they get some real players around him and, after next year, he's going to be really good. But I think he's more dependent on the players around him than, say, a guy like Fox.
Yeah, I got a lot of questions. I'm worried about his finishing ability. I'm really worried about his finishing ability. And
yeah, I don't think he's going to be great at it. I think that's kind of what I wrote is in Summer League, it's tough to tell because there's so much chaos in Summer League games. I think there was close to 40 turnovers in his debut. There's so much chaos. There's so many things, defensive breakdowns. There's so many things happening that won't consistently happen in the NBA, which creates opportunities for guys to score. I was shocked at how he was defended when I went back and watched all the tape. I kind of noticed it just off my first eyeball watching the games. But when I went back and really looked at it, I can't believe the way he was being guarded on the perimeter, particularly in the pick and roll, with defenders who were trying to make teams, trying to make a name for themselves. And they weren't trying to go over the screen. They weren't trying to go under. The big wasn't hedging. They were literally falling back and basically begging. They were giving him Rajon Rondo-like space to shoot from the top of the key dead on. And he still shot less than 24% from three. I can't believe that. So he's not going to get those shots in the NBA. What I liked is I saw, and it's also, I think a big thing is when he's going left or right, half the court really as a scorer is cut off for Lonzo. When he goes right, he's going to have a very difficult time either coming off a screen or a ball screen or in catch and shoot. He's going to have a very difficult time pulling up because he's got to bring the ball back to his left with that funky form, which brings it right into the trailing defender. If you watch, I watched him all year when I was editing last year for college basketball, and I watched a lot of him at UCLA. And he almost never pulled up from mid range. When he did, it was never going right. Never going right. So you can really, as a defender, lock in on when he goes right, he is going to pass. You can play him pretty much primarily as a passer when he goes right. He did show a little bit of a runner going right in Summer League. So those types of tweaks, he's a smart player. He's very skilled. So he's probably going to compensate in ways, but I think him going right is going to sort of limit half the court, at least in his early development. So little details like that, I just don't quite know what to make of him next year.
Yeah, I think for him, a lot of it is going to depend on, like, I don't think he can be the best guy. There's an it factor with him that I think a lot of players or a lot of fans are counting on. Like, he's got an it factor that very few guys have, and that carries over on when you watch him. That really carries over. It's why the stats you're like, ugh, and then you watch him and you're like, is because he's got a huge it factor, and that'll win him some accolades and help him a lot. But at the other time, I think
in the short term,
like most rookies, but I think particularly with him, there are gonna be nights when he is devastatingly bad. Like, he is just, well, there are gonna be nights when you're like, he was just bad tonight.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think you're right about that. He can't be the best player on your team. Or certainly not the best scorer. I think he's a guy that's gonna bring a good team and really bring them together. He can probably be, in some capacity what a Rondo was with those really good Boston teams. He's a better shooter than Rondo. He's not near the defender as Rondo. But I think he can and will be an all-star level player. I do think that. But like going back to our Curry conversation last week, he will be more circumstantial. And if he never ends up on a team that can complement and highlight what he's really good at, he could very easily end up being Ricky Rubio. I think that's kind of his baseline. I think he's going to be Ricky Rubio.
I don't know if he's going to be that good defensively.
Well, he won't be, but he's going to be better offensively. And so I think in terms of impact on the game, that's sort of his baseline.
That's an issue though, man. Like, if you're Ricky Rubio and you're bad at defense, I don't know if that's an NBA player. That's like a...
Yeah, but Ricky Rubio would love, I mean, Lonzo Ball can shoot when he's open, and he is going to get open shots. And he can shoot going left. He can shoot with really good range. And I think he's going to be a pretty athletic finisher. He's going to do a lot more offensively than Rubio. And even if the passing is equal, he does so many other things offensively that it would balance out.
Here's my thing. I've criticized Rubio consistently for a lot of reasons, and I stand by those. Particularly, like, his finishing ability is a real issue. Like, he shot 44% around the rim last year. Like, that's horrific. However, he was 50th percentile on jump shots last year. He shot 39% on jump shots, which is 50th percentile, even up. And, you know, unguarded on catch and shoots, he shot 38%, which is fine. He shot 53.8 EFG last year, according to Synergy. Off the dribble, he was even better. He shot 43%, which is 69th percentile. Like, this is the thing, is Rubio's problem isn't really his jumper. It's not great, but it's fine. It's okay. His problem is he can't finish at the rim. And so, again, my kind of thing is, I don't know if like, Rubio's whole thing is he makes everybody on the court a little bit better. And I got to see if Lonzo's able to do that before I'm able to really buy in. Now, at the same time, like, yeah, he'll do
like, that.
All the factors are there, and everyone's like, he just scored 30-whatever points in summer league. And it's true.
No, forget the points. Forget the points. There's a lot of summer league buckets in there. But he will make other people better. The question is, you can only make certain people so good.
Yeah.
And that's what it's going to come down to.
Are there any other rookies that you're, like, 100% in on? That you're just like...
Yeah, I really like De'Aaron Fox. I mean, if Fox can develop a jumper, he's going to be a better player than Ball. He's a beast on the ball defensively. I mean, I really like De'Aaron Fox. But, I mean, who wasn't pumped on the Mitchell kid in Utah? But Dennis Smith, I think, is a really interesting case because there's a lot of things that, like, basketball purists don't like about Smith. Like, he's sort of like that conventional sort of ball hog type guy. There was a lot of criticism on him coming into the draft that he doesn't try every night. He's not 100% engaged on every play. But I mean, look, the guy can flat out score. I think he's going to be an above average shooter. He reminds me a lot of like a Damian Lillard. He's just a great, great athlete. And I'm really intrigued by him. I think Dennis Smith could end up being right up there. I think to say he could end up being the best point guard in this class is not at all a stretch, and it's a really good rookie point guard class.
Yeah, I think I like Fox. He's quick. The shooting thing I think is obviously a concern with him as well, but the athleticism, I think he's going to be a killer finisher. I like Tatum.
Well, just his straight line speed, too. I mean, you know, he can probably become like a John Wall. That's pretty reasonable. That's pretty good.
I like Tatum a lot. I don't know if he's going to get the minutes or the shots, but when I started doing draft work, he was a guy that really jumped out to me. I think there's a reasonable concern that he's going to be a black hole offensively, that he's just never going to pass. A lot of it's going to depend, like, if Brad Stevens could integrate that guy and get the most out of him, you know, he said the other day, he was like, look, they were going to take me number one. The Sixers just didn't know about it, and they said they traded, but he basically feels like I'm the number one pick in the draft, which is a reasonable way to feel because the team with the number one decided to pick him. At the same time, you know, a lot of it's going to depend on, is he going to add those other things? Like, is he going to rebound? Is he going to be able to pass? And especially, is he going to be able to defend? Because Boston's going to be in situations where he can't just not defend next year. It's not doable. I mean, I guess there are guys that have been parts of teams that were just like, if he's just like Maurice Spates right out the box for them in that role, that kind of works. Like,
he's going to be better than that. He's a really polished scorer. To your point, I could reasonably see the over the duration of Tatum's career, him becoming like a Rudy Gay.
Yeah.
And that's a pretty good player. I think Rudy Gay is better than a lot of people think, but in a lot of circumstances, his holes outweigh what he does really, really well. And I can see Tatum becoming that kind of player. I think for me personally, with Tatum, it's always going to be a question of what they passed on to keep him. I think, I wrote the other day when I was talking about the decision for a team to trade Kyrie, and it's all about player control and how long you have them. And I understand that it's a very, very difficult decision for a GM to make. When you're looking at Tatum, clearly the Celtics aren't as good next year with Tatum as they would have been with Butler. And there was a way they could get Butler. There was a way they could maneuver their roster to get Butler and Hayward. And so I think the question is always going to be, how far is too far down the road to plan? Because right now the Celtics are obviously planning for like the end of these rookie scales. For these rookie contracts, when maybe the Warriors fall off, maybe LeBron falls off, and they're sort of planning down the road, which isn't not smart, but it's a fundamental question. It's sort of like anything in life. Like, how much do you live right now in the moment, and how much do you plan? And realistically, how much better of a position can a team be in than a number one seed in its conference? Just got Gordon Hayward. I mean, the Warriors and the Cavs in the East are kind of scaring them, but they're pretty ready to win right now, and that's going to be my criticism of Tatum moving. It's not that I don't, if I evaluate him in a vacuum, I think he's a good player. I think he's a really polished scorer. I think he can end up definitely being a multiple all-star player. But I'm always going to measure it against what they maybe could have gotten for him. And that's for me, he's not being measured against other rookies. To me, he's being measured against what he could have gotten in a package with Avery Bradley and a couple of other parts and gotten back, a known quantity, you know, a bird in the hand. You know what you have in Jimmy Butler.
Outside of Lauri Markkanen, who I think is obviously the number one, and Zach Collins, who I think is obviously the number two, what top 10 pick would shock you the most by winning Rookie of the Year?
Ooh, okay. What do you think about Zach Collins?
Good.
Have you watched him much?
Rotation.
Yeah,
player.
I think. I think he can be better than that. I think he has similar. When I watch him and I watch Lonzo Ball, I think they're the big and perimeter equivalent of each other. I don't think Collins is near the level of Ball, but he has that same feel for his surroundings. He's got really good footwork. He's got just a really good feel for in the box type thing.
Yeah.
And I think that stuff translates a lot more than people think. When you just feel your game, I think he could be really good up in Portland. You know, Markkanen, I don't know. He sort of fits a mold. He's a 7-footer who can shoot. Would it shock me if, I mean, the kid with the Knicks, I can't pronounce his name. Do you know how to pronounce the name?
Ntilikina, I think.
Ntilikina? I mean, I don't know much about him. It wouldn't shock me if Smith won. It wouldn't shock me if Ball won. It wouldn't shock me if Fox won. It would not shock me if Fultz won. Who are we missing here? If Markkanen won, I'd be really shocked.
Jackson
Absolutely.
And Isaac are the other two.
Isaac, it would shock me. Usually the rookie of the year is the guy who's scoring the ball.
Yeah.
So, I mean, from there you're looking at probably Fultz, Dennis Smith, Fox, depending on how much time he gets with Hill there. But I would say those three probably, and then Lonzo Ball just for the it factor. That's going to go a long way.
And last thing, so going up on CBS Sports today, I've got an article on players that would have been forward specifically. I'm actually, I found so many, I'm doing centers next week. But I'm doing forwards today that would have been way better now versus back in the day. And that prompted the question of...
You mean back in the day players that would have been better now?
Yes.
Okay, yeah.
Back in the day guys that would have been better now. So like, it leads with Kevin Garnett, who actually would have been as good as he was, MVP level, Hall of Famer. He'd be insane now. Just absurd because of how much switching there is in the NBA, how few big men there are, how much more positional versatility is important. His range would have been way better. Like he would have immediately started shooting threes.
Yeah, that's for sure.
His point totals would have been even more outrageous. Like KG would have been nuts today.
And we agree, already probably a top 15 player ever.
Yeah. Yeah. He'd be even higher now. And then I've got Chris Webber was the number two name on my list. And man, C-Web would just kill today. Like
just with the way the ball moves. Those Kings teams played a lot like the teams play now.
Yeah. That's the thing I kind of found is like all the ball movement and everything, the transition play. But part of it also is just Webber he was capable of being a better 3-point shooter than he was. Like he was shooting, I think like 39% before he went to Sacramento, and then it dropped to like nothing because he just stopped taking him. All these guys basically got to like after their rookie season, just like were like, or after their first 3 years in the league, their coaches were just like, you're a big, stop shooting threes. Okay. Mm-hmm. And like that was just it. And so all these guys I think would have been better. Grant Hill's an interesting one. Larry Bird was another one that I started actually thinking about how many more points Bird would have scored if he just shot more threes. Like, he just didn't take them because it was a novelty when he was in the league. Like, those were gimmick shots when you were in the NBA when Larry Bird was in there. And if he played now, good Lord. I mean, just good Lord. Because he's arguably a better shooter than even Kevin Durant. As good as Kevin Durant is.
You know, what's interesting is if you looked at the opposite of what guys were really good back then that maybe wouldn't be now. I mean, you get a lot of people up in arms if you started talking about maybe Isaiah Thomas. And you wonder, okay, I got a 6-footer who's not a great 3-point shooter. And he's not going to be able to play that hand-checking defense that he was huge for when he played. Would Isaiah Thomas be, you know, a top 3 point guard in the league as he was for the duration of his career. Those things would be interesting. Maybe like a guy like, to go the other way who wasn't, because Larry Bird, Kevin Garnett, they were great in their time. They'd be maybe a little bit greater now, but maybe like, you know, what about like Detlef Schrempf? You know, a guy that, you know, a big who can shoot, but was just kind of a role player with the Sonics. Would he be a great player now? Those kind of things might be interesting.
I think it's more the traditional bigs. Like, what's Charles Barkley in today's NBA?
Well, he wasn't a traditional big. I mean, he was 6'4". I mean, Barkley still, I don't know, but when Barkley went to Phoenix, he could shoot. He did shoot some threes. He was not a great 3-point shooter, but I think, yeah, Barkley plays. His athleticism was freakish in his prime of his career. He plays. I don't know what he is.
But here's a question. I mean, we know now, like, if you're a big, here's the issue. As we talked about before, like, if you're a guard, you can get away with being bad defensively. It's fine. Like, it's okay if you're a bad point guard defensively.
Yeah, yeah.
But there's just a million of them. Right? Some of the best ones in the league, even though, like, Westbrook's capable of it, but Westbrook just won MVP, and he is legitimately a bad defender at this point, because of how little he gives a crap. And the same is true for Isaiah Thomas. For him, it's the size issue, and Steph Curry is only fine. But if you're a big, you get exploited. Mm-hmm. Like, you get torn to pieces.
Yeah.
So,
like a Kevin Love in certain matchups.
Yeah. Like, if you're putting Barkley in pick-and-roll situations over and over and over and over and over again, what's he gonna do? You know.
Well, like, I think it's interesting. I mean, I just stumbled onto that, but I think Barkley's probably maybe the rough equivalent of a Kevin Love. Now he wouldn't be the shooter that Love is, but he'd be better at other things, which would kind of equal out offensively.
He's more aggressive.
I mean, he's just more athletic. Barkley was a terrific, very very strong finisher. I mean, you know, there'd be a lot of things that would still translate. I think he'd probably be a little bit better than Kevin Love offensively, a little bit better player, but kind of an equal sib on defense and rebound. Kevin Love's a really good rebounder. He's still a really, really good rebounder. So that's a rough equivalent, you know, a good player, an all-star player, but not the best player on a championship team by any stretch.
Not MVP, I think he was in 93. And look, Barkley was legit.
Would you take Draymond Green, like, right now, like, Draymond Green right now, he does not have the status in the league right now that Barkley had in his prime. But I would say right now in today's game, I would take Draymond over prime Barkley.
I mean, I wouldn't, because Barkley was legit MVP in 93 and deserved it. If we're playing game, I would take
What I'm saying right now in today's game.
But by the same token, even though I find most of the conversations about how current players in the, like, I think if you put LeBron at any point in history, he's going to dominate. He's going to be great no matter when. Because he's LeBron James.
Oh, I don't buy these guys that are great now. They wouldn't be able to.
Right. I don't think all of them. However, I think specifically Draymond Green would have a lot of problems in like the year 2000, because part of it was I started thinking this came up also during my matchup of the greatest champions. Like when I did that tournament before the playoffs started. Like I was looking actually at I wound up looking at a lot of stuff on Horace Grant, and then on. Like just a few other guys, and because I was watching so much Kings tape, I was watching a lot of these of the Lakers matchups. And one of Grant Hill's best games, like one of the highlight clips on YouTube, is Grant Hill versus Kobe and Shaq. So I actually got to go back and watch a lot of Shaq and remember just boy. I asked Marcus Thompson on Twitter today of the Athletic in San Francisco. I asked him, I was like, how would Draymond do versus Shaq? Because Marcus is Mr. Never try and go at Draymond in the post. It's suicide. And he was like, no chance for Draymond. Like, Draymond's got no chance.
Oh, yeah. No one, I don't think, in history had a chance on
Shaq. So that's kind of the thing. Is like back in the day when guys had – and because remember, all those teams had dudes that were roughly Shaq's size. Like, how's Draymond going to do back in like 2000? What kind of role does he play? Because that was one of the things. Draymond literally broke the tweener label. Like he himself shattered that label. And I think it's great that he did, and it's awesome what he's become. He's my favorite Warrior to watch. But at the same time, you put him back in like 95 and you put him on the Bulls, you know, is he going to be better than Horace Grant was? I don't know. At what they were asked to do, I don't know.
Well, they'd be limited too, by sort of the boxed in way that people played back then. So yeah, he probably wouldn't be able to expand a
like
3-point game.
That was the thing, you can't do, like, you just couldn't do as much because coaches and the game itself wouldn't let you.
Yeah. Yeah, he would certainly wouldn't be the kind of playmaker he's become with the Warriors. But I mean, look, I think it's interesting also from the standpoint of how different you are makes a big difference. And back then, there was a lot of physical defenders. You know, he wouldn't have stood out so much as he does now. It's very hard to play physical defense now without fouling, right. And he does. Yeah. So he's one of five or six guys that can do it, and he's different. Like, everybody did it back then. That's what's always my argument. That's always my argument when people say, like, well, this guy couldn't play defense. You know, Curry doesn't play defense. Westbrook doesn't play defense. Well, Westbrook would be a hell of a better defender if he could just grab you and hold you. It's not – it's hard to play defense right now because you actually have to do it with your feet. And so I don't always buy the argument that, oh, he couldn't have done it back then because things would be different back then too. You could compensate for not having as much basketball skill back then by just being physical. Right. That's it. Nothing more.
Well,
Dale Davis,
and by the same token, like if the Warriors played those Lakers, because this was actually a really interesting question that I had. I tend to think, and I said this, that the Warriors would beat that team just because the Lakers.
What, the Shaq Kobe team?
Yeah, because the Lakers just did not have the 3-point, like the math problem gets them. That's where I keep coming back to is like, even if Shaq's scoring 60% of the time, you don't have the shooters in Rick Fox and Devin George and those kind of guys on those teams that are going to be able to keep up with what the Warriors would do. Like, the Warriors would, I think, adapt, even though they've gone more to cuts and at the rim, they would go back to just bombing from deep. And that
well, that's yeah, that, I think that really interesting team is the one you pointed out on Twitter, which is that 95 Magic team, which was built to play right now. I mean, you got a prime rookie, but just freakishly athletic Shaq, who could definitely run the floor. He wouldn't be a stretch big by any mean, but he would just dominate anyone in the inside that the Warriors have, just completely dominate. And then you have all the shooters with Scott and Anderson.
Yeah, people really don't get like how crazy Dennis Scott was shooting. Like in 96, that dude was launching 7.7 three-pointers a game, which... Yeah. By the way, as a comparison, like Curry averages over like 10, like a lot of players average over 10. It's just crazy how much the league has expanded in that realm. But in 96, 7.7 was a ton. And he was shooting 43%. Like Dennis Scott today would rule.
He'd be up with the best shooters in the league for sure. I didn't watch enough Scott to, you know, he would be Dennis Scott, I don't know enough about his defensive abilities, but yeah, he could probably very easily be a shooter like Klay Thompson.
And then, you know, like, I one of the guys that is going to lead the guard section next week is Anthony Hardaway, Penny. I mean, 6'7", athletic, could do anything. I think that his three-point shooting would have gotten there if he played in today's NBA. The thing I keep watching with Hardaway is, like, what if Tyreke Evans was way, 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 way better? That's what I keep coming back to. It's like... With what Tyreke was capable of his rookie season before, like, teams figured out how to simply guard him, if you had in all of Hardaway's just his vision and everything else, like, he would be ridiculous. And that matchup versus the Warriors would be crazy. Like, Hardaway and Penny versus this Warriors team with Dennis Scott able to kind of keep pace and some of the other shooters too, that would be a really fun matchup.
It's interesting, and getting back to our original topic tonight, or today, in what would, you know, make for the most interesting league in this conference imbalance and who would be good and who wouldn't be good. It's interesting to ask yourself, has there ever been, shouldn't the league right now be in a place more than any other time in history to be have its most parity? I think right now there's more superstar players in the league than there's ever been. And so it's frustrating to me on a very surface level of why the league can't get to a greater place of parity when there are so many great players.
I legitimately believe it's because the talent isn't as important as it used to be. I agree with you that there's more superstar talent. The problem is that the game has evolved to a place where it matters way more how you play together than the individual weaponry that you have.
You still need the weaponry, though. Like, you still have to start with the weapons.
But here's the thing, man, is, like, you say that. Where does Danny Green rank on the Spurs in terms of ex-best player?
Yeah, not very high, but I don't think the Spurs...
No, think about it, though. All right, so Kawhi, LaMarcus.
Yeah, the Spurs are kind of, they're obviously an exception.
But
their players over the course of this run, when the Spurs have become the Spurs, their players have been a lot better than people give them. It's sort of like the Patriots.
No, they're good. They're good, but they're not superstar talent. And you have to remember, like, how good they were, because when teams fall off, we diminish them if they did not win. If the Indiana Pacers had won the 2013 NBA title, we would remember them entirely differently because they won the title. But they got to the conference finals, challenged LeBron seriously, and fell in a hard-fought matchup. Like, they gave the Heat everything that they could handle. Okay? But those Pacers teams, like, Lance Stephenson was arguably the third or fourth best player on those teams. But it was how they played together. And I'm going to keep hammering this, which is, and this is what I wrote after the finals too. If you want your team to be great, it cannot be, I just got to have great players everywhere. You've got to play with everybody playing together with sacrifice, ball movement, and a commitment on defense. Like, there's got to be better team play. Your offense can't be like Randy Whitman's, where Bradley Beal's taking a bunch of two shots off the dribble, mid-range jump shots. Can't do it. You cannot do it. You cannot waste a great shooter like Bradley Beal on those mid-range jump shots when he could be shooting those threes. You can't do it. And we saw a jump this year with him. You look at all of these teams, and if the more that those teams play together and with better chemistry and better together, that's where the talent is going to make the rest of the guys better, and the rest of the guys are going to make that superstar talent better. That, to me, is the biggest issue. If we look at the Clippers, that, to me, is the other thing, is that Clippers team should have been better. They were great. They had a number one offensive, like, their starters were incredible. But they never really hit their peak, in which they were just absolutely destroying people. And there's a lot of reasons for it in the playoffs, and you can point to a lot of things that went on. But the biggest problem, I think, is everybody kind of watched them, and they, like, Doc just simply wasn't imaginative enough. Like, Doc just had them play, like, standard pick-and-roll basketball. And
yeah, your point's well taken that you need fit matters. I still think to be elite, you can fit as well as you want. You need both. You have to have... at least star players, multiple ones, to compete at the highest level. And then the Warriors have upped the bar by saying you have to fit together too.
You cannot win at the highest level. Like, you can't get past the second round without star players. Like, you can play together and play great. You're not going to go further than that. Because eventually, I agree with you. Like, the biggest problem is honestly just clutch situations. Is that you get into the last 5 minutes of a tight game. I mean, look at it. Like, The Cavs did everything humanly possible to win game three. They did everything humanly possible to win game three. And then, like, what happened? Like, Kevin Durant hit a last second shot at the buzzer because he's Kevin Durant. What are you going
to
do?
I look at it like, to your point, these guys, they have to play together, they have to fit together. It all has to make sense from a chemistry, on-court chemistry standpoint.
But I think that but the problem, though, is, like, everyone kind of points to there's not enough talent, or the talent needs to be consolidated, and I don't think that that's true.
No, there's more than enough. That's what I'm saying. Yeah. There's more players, and it's not just the star players, in my opinion. It's trickling down to even the mid-level players. There's so many good, so many skilled players. Like I said, back in the day, a lot of teams were constructed with a lot of integral parts that weren't that skilled of players, but they had within the confines of the rules back then, they could play a different game and still be beneficial to the team. Now there are so many skilled players, I don't think that there's any reason that these teams shouldn't be better than they are. I don't know if the Warriors are skewing it, but I was watching I texted you, I was watching on NBA TV some past finals game. It was the 08 finals. Celtics Lakers, and on the court at one time in a finals game is Leon Poe, Sasha Vujacic, Eddie House, Posey, Glenn Davis, and Jordan Farmar in a finals game. Like, now I know you're going to start telling me, well, this guy was better than you think, and Eddie House could really shoot, and boy, Leon Poe, he was something, and Jordan Farmar was pretty decent. Like, fine, they were at that time, but think about the third and fourth options on teams now.
Well, no, but to be fair, you're not talking about third and fourth options, because on Boston, the third and fourth option was Ray Allen and then Rajon Rondo.
No, but in any given lineup, not on the whole team, but in this lineup right here, all you had was, the particular possession I was looking at, Pierce and Kobe were offsetting each other. After that, the number two option on the team, start picking up, the number two option in that lineup for the Celtics was Posey, I guess. And the number two option for the Lakers was probably Vujicic in that lineup. And it's just...
Well, versus what, though? Like, let's take the Warriors out of it. Who else? Like, let's do a comparison.
Well, I don't know. I mean, and when I watch an NBA game now...
Like, let's take a look at it. So, like, if LeBron sits, it's Kyrie and then Love, but we know that lineup is absolute garbage. Like, we know that versus everybody, those teams
For defensive reasons.
No, like, I mean, overall, like, they got outscored. Like...
Yeah, but it's for defensive reasons. I mean, the numbers don't go... Offensively, the numbers don't fall off that much.
They fall off a lot. They fall off more than you think.
Okay, well, still, you have two star players on the court.
Yeah, but it doesn't matter because they don't play the right way, right?
Maybe.
That's the thing.
Maybe,
like,
but...
You know, and I mean, look, I think that 08 finals was a slugfest, for sure, because what you had basically that season, you got to remember, like, Steve Kerr literally sabotaged unintentionally. Like, he sabotaged 7 seconds or less that season, right? Like,
that's the year that he did. It's very ironic because, you know, he didn't think you could win.
I know. He didn't think you could win small.
Playing at that
pace. It just kills me. To this day, it just absolutely kills me.
But he went and got Shaq.
Yeah. He traded Sean Marion for Shaq, and it kills me every single time. So 7 seconds or less falls off. That Spurs team was not great that season. And then really, and the Mavericks were still kind of trying to recover from the 07 collapse. So, seriously, the other best team in 2008, as I told you, was, like, that Charlotte Hornets team. If you want to say, like, who was the third best player when, you know, in any sort of given lineup, if it was Chris Paul, well, a lot of times that third best player was somebody like Peja Stojakovic, who was still really good, or, like, those guys, like, actually were pretty decent. And then in the East, you got to remember, like, that Celtics team was driven, and you say, like, well, what about these lineups? And you're right that in those situations... But that was part of that 08 season was fascinating in that Doc Rivers was never a good rotations coach. When he had deep rotations, he couldn't figure it out. He was never good at balancing deep rosters. He's still not good at that. And so that's why he won in 08 was because he didn't have to, because realistically, I'd have to look it up, but Pierce, Allen, and KG played almost the entire game all the time. They just played the big three all the time, and they won with that superior talent. I do wonder with that 08 team, as good as their defense was, which it was otherworldly, it was so good. But like, I really do wonder, like, I don't think that team scores enough to nearly hang with any of the last four NBA champions.
Yeah.
You know? And I think that Celtics team it passes my smell test for all-time greats, because I think about this a lot with finals teams. It's not just, okay, you're a great team because you made the finals. If you make the finals, I think you're a great team. Like, unless there was just like a whole bunch of hijinks going on. Like an injury, like the 2000, honestly, it's really weird, but like, I seriously think that like the 2007 Spurs were just not great. Like the Robert Horry thing happened and the Mavs got beat by the Warriors. Like a bunch of weird stuff happened that year. The 07, Cavs for sure were not a great team. Like
I was watching last night on NBA TV. I was watching the, 11 finals, Mavs, Heat. And I totally forgot Deshaun Stevenson was on the Mavericks. Was shocked, probably as shocked as I was back then, but I'd forgotten at how good J.J. Barea was. And I was shocked at watching the Heat play in Game 6 with the series on the line. They refused to shoot a jump shot, and it just stood out to me. Nobody would shoot down the stretch in the fourth quarter. I watched the whole fourth quarter, and as the Mavs kept maintaining their 6-8 point lead, LeBron refused to shoot a jump shot and was just forcing his way into the lane and not doing anything. In the end of that game with the season, he was really, really bad, like doing nothing. Dwayne Wade refused to shoot a jumper. He was really carrying the offense down the stretch. Those things stood out to me that Barea was kind of unstoppable for a crucial stretch of that game 6 and in a lot of that series. They couldn't stop him. JJ Barea.
Yeah.
And two, I was just shocked at how limited that Miami offense was. And I don't want to jump to the conclusion just from watching one game or rewatching one game, but they were just so limited when it came down to it. And this is sort of always my argument of, you need shooting because in the end, that's sort of like, that's the shot you can always get. If you have to force your way to the rim, you have to get to the rim. Yeah. It's hard to get there in late game situations, and they wouldn't shoot. LeBron just would not shoot.
Well, and the biggest jump was in 2012 was they had Shane Battier, and that changed everything for them. Like 2012, people do not understand how big of an impact Shane Battier meant for that team, and then Ray Allen came on board. Like,
yeah. Well, when I watched LeBron in that game, I guess when I went back to it, I said, okay, this game right here.
Yeah.
This is why people laugh when someone says, oh, he's as good as Jordan. Now, LeBron has progressed to a level where I think right now it is a coin flip. But back then, when he was still the best player in the world, everyone thought he was the best player in the world. And I watched that game and it's like, okay, now I see what we're talking about.
He narrowed the gap considerably between 2012 and now. Like, that's the thing is it took him, he was a ways away. Obviously,
I didn't realize how far away.
Yeah, he was.
I guess is
like,
what I'm
saying. Part of it was he had never hit like a really clutch jumper, and people forget this. He nailed an absolutely massive, like nail in the coffin game 7 shot in 2013 that no one ever talks about because everyone just remembers the Ray Allen shot. But like LeBron hit an absolute hammer the nail. It's over. Like.
Yeah. He was still progressing that year. That game was on too on NBA TV, and he wasn't great down that stretch in Game 6. That Ray Allen really bailed him out. He was at least taking the shots.
Taking them, though. That's what you always talk about.
He was taking the threes, but in that Mavs series, he just flat out was just standing around.
No, he went to pieces.
And it blew my mind.
He went to pieces. All right, we got to run. This has been fun. You can catch us. We'll be back later this week with more talk about all the stuff. Check out our work on CBS Sports. Brad, thanks for joining me.
Okay, thanks.